Good afternoon, this is Marco for the first show of 2021. And welcome to all fellow astronomers or people that like astronomy or can't get enough astronomy. So that's me. So just want to inform people there's the Quadrantide meteor shower. I'm sorry if I don't pronounce it well. But there's a meteor shower going on, but of course we can't see it. And what else is new? Well, the Earth is slowly in its orbit, is going to make it so in about 5 months, on June 22nd, will be the longest day of the year, the longest sunlight. So we just went through the winter solstice where we had the shortest day of the year. Doesn't seem to me that there's much global warming because we have a lot of rain. It's a bit warmer than usual, and just rain. So welcome. I was watching, of course, my favorite TV program on BBC Earth, and now they're talking about life. I've seen this one before, but it's always good to see them again. It jogs your memory. And they're talking about exoplanets and things like that. And one thing on the previous program, they talked about certain things about just our universe and things that make you think a lot. So I want to first correct some things that I said in previous shows. When I listen to my shows again and I make podcasts of them, I said, did I say that? You know, and one thing, when I interview professors, sometimes they get some little, let's say, facts wrong because they're off by certain orders of magnitude on what they say is happening on temperatures or on distance or whatever. So I do that too, even though I think I know what I'm talking about, and sometimes I don't because I say the wrong thing. So one of the things that I want to correct is something called the Planck length. In physics, the Planck length is a unit of length that is a distance light in a perfect vacuum travels in one unit of Planck time. So there, makes it all simple, right? A Planck length is the distance light travels in a perfect vacuum in one unit of Planck time. So what's a unit of Planck time? Okay, it is also the reduced Compton wavelength of a particle with Planck mass. Now that makes it simpler, doesn't it? Not really. Okay, here we go. It is equal to 1.61625 times 10 to the minus 35 meters. It is the base unit in the system of Planck units developed by physicist Max Planck. The Planck length can be defined from three fundamental physical constants, the speed of light in a vacuum, the Planck constant, and the gravitational constant. It is the smallest distance about which currently experimentally corroborated models of physics can make meaningful statements. At such small distances, the conventional laws of macrophysics no longer apply, and even relativistic physics requires special treatment. According to our current understanding of physics, the Planck length is the shortest unit of length possible in space-time due to the impossibility of observing anything smaller. So I said before it was 1.6 times 10 to the minus 16th. I was wrong. And I thought then later when I said, okay, maybe it's 1 times 6 times 10 to the minus 14. Apparently, no, it's 1.6 times 10 to the minus 35. So basically what I thought the Planck length was is the shortest distance that can be measured. And since we're traveling or talking about such small things, let's talk about the zeposecond, the shortest unit of time ever measured. I talked about that a couple weeks ago. So the zeposecond is scientists have measured the shortest unit of time ever, the time it takes a light particle to cross a hydrogen molecule. It's 247 zeposecond. A zeposecond is a trillionth of a billionth of a second, or a decimal point followed by 20 zeros and a one. So now, I know you guys were all worrying about this during Christmas and New Year's, and now it's been cleared up, so you can rest easy, you can have a good 2021, because I know you guys were worried about the exact distance and the exact time of things like Planck length and Zeppel seconds. So anyway, so what am I going to talk about now? I'm fumbling and bumbling. So let's talk about our star, our planet, and efforts by astronomers to find planets similar to Earth in our, I guess, the Milky Way. So our star, I guess it's, if you think of it, is it a big star or a small star? I believe this program I was listening to said 77% of the stars in the Milky Way are smaller than the Sun. And most of them are M-type stars, where they are called red dwarfs. And they're about, I think I wrote something down here and it's wrong. So what I wanted to say was M-type stars are stars that are candidates for exoplanet searches. And the astronomers have been focusing in on these M-type stars, these things called red dwarfs, and they have found some planets that could be candidate Earths that are similar to Earth. When astronomers look for exoplanets that are same size as Earth, they also want to find, they think, well, wouldn't it be nice if they had the same size star like the Sun? So we could think, okay, is this a candidate for life? Could life exist on these places? So what happens in a red dwarf star, they have found, and I'll talk about the telescopes called TESS and Kepler. So Kepler, I think, was the first dedicated satellite or observatory or whatever you want to call it that went, I think, in 2007 or 2009 to look for exoplanets, and it found many of them. Before Kepler, when astronomers tried to announce they had found a possible or an exoplanet candidate, a lot of other astronomers would go, no, your data's wrong. You're actually misinterpreting your data. It's some kind of variation or fluctuation in the star. It's not a planet, blah, blah, blah. So that's when they had to go back and say, well, look, this planet transit method, we can confirm that this is an exoplanet by doing the, it's up right on the tip of my tongue, but I think when the planet tugs on, I think it's called the wobble method. So the first exoplanets, I believe in 1995, were found by the wobble method, where astronomers would measure the wobble that the particular exoplanet candidate would create in the star. And when they were measuring that wobble, then they could say, okay, here is that exoplanet, we think. But when this new technology came, like a lot of new theories, there's a lot of doubters at first, and certain people have said in black hole theory and black hole research and things like that, it was career suicide to even tell people you were doing things like that, because people would think, you're a loon. And it took time for these things to be confirmed and accepted. So when the first Kepler went up, there was doubt. There was other astronomers would challenge astronomers and say, well, look, from this transit method, when the planet passes in front of the star and dims the light by a minuscule amount there, we can tell that there is a planet. So it took time to accept it. Like a lot of theories, it takes time to accept it. And even as I said last time, Einstein sometimes doubted his own conclusions from his theories, like in gravitational waves, in black holes, and the expansion of the universe, as we know, the fudge factor. Einstein couldn't accept the fact initially that the universe was expanding. So then later, when things are proved, and then other satellites are launched, like TESS in 2018, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite is a space telescope for NASA's Explorer program designed to search for exoplanets using the transit method in an area 400 times larger than that covered by the Kepler mission. It was launched April 18, 2018, atop a Falcon 9 rocket and placed into a highly elliptical 13.7-day orbit around Earth. The first light image from TESS was taken on August 7, 2018 and released publicly on September 17. So apparently, over the course of the two-year mission, TESS was expected to ultimately detect about 1,250 transiting exoplanets orbiting the targeted stars, and an additional 13,000 transiting planets orbiting additional stars in the field that TESS observed. And I believe what they were going to do with TESS is they were going to do one hemisphere and search in the Milky Way in that one hemisphere, and the next year they would search in the next hemisphere for exoplanets. So this exoplanet thing is taken off, and I did have an interview with somebody quite a few years ago. They were working on the WFIRST telescope mission, and WFIRST would be the telescope or the observatory succeeding the James Webb Space Telescope. And I believe James Webb will aid in things for exoplanet hunters, but also it will confirm something on Mars and do a lot of cool stuff. So all this, in our first two generations, we believe in, I don't want to quote the exact date, but the Soviets were the first into space. So we've been playing around with space for about two generations now. And I could just imagine what it's going to be like in two generations after that. But one of the things about exoplanet research is that the astronomers are looking for things like oxygen and methane, because unless there's life, this person that I listened to on the TV said, and he's an astronomer, so I'm just kind of quoting him. I'm not saying that I know this for certain. I'm just regurgitating what somebody else, much smarter than me, said. Says you couldn't find oxygen and methane. It's formed by life processes. So what they're going to look for is certain gases that could be telltale signs of life. Just like when you look at the sky and you see X-rays or gamma rays and things like that, you say, aha, that tells me it's a black hole or whatever, or it's a neutron star, or it's merging neutron stars, or it's a blah, 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 whatever it is. So there was great excitement when you just even like myself read up on astronomy and the amazing things that the conclusions that could be made. So they're not difficult conclusions to grasp, because if a scientist tells you unless there's life, exoplanet would not produce oxygen and methane and maybe carbon dioxide in the amount that we have on Earth. And one thing that has made that was really interesting to me when I was watching a NASA show on when they're training astronauts, one of the people, I think he's a Canadian, he's been in space before, and he says our atmosphere has held pretty steady at 20.9% oxygen in its atmosphere for quite a while now. And so tonight another astronomer was saying if another alien species is looking at us and somehow measuring things about our planet, and they're saying, oh, look at that, there's oxygen in the atmosphere, there's methane in the atmosphere, maybe there's carbon dioxide, that means there's life there. So these exoplanet researchers have developed such sophisticated methods in studying stars, and it's very exciting, especially when the future in space is just building on previous knowledge. And as I said, for these past two generations, we have been really taking it to the cosmos in a way that was never done before that. And that just breeds so much excitement. And that if they could keep me alive for another 100 years, I know my jaw would drop at what things they are discovering. So just to conclude, they're M-type stars with these red dwarfs, they're called red dwarfs, they're M-type stars, and these are star systems or stars that host candidate exoplanets that rocky planets similar to the size of the Earth. And one of the things that the astronomer said tonight was that these in planet formation, the most efficient way to make a planet is to make a smaller rocky planet, not a big Jupiter-sized planet, even though they seem to be finding a lot of hot Jupiters out there. Okay, so one of the problems, I said I'm going to conclude, but I'll conclude with this. One of the problems with red dwarf stars and the rocky planets that they found, astronomers believe they're too close. So the planet would be tidally locked with the star, and that means the same face of the planet would face the star all the time. So Mercury is a weird planet because I believe its year is, or its day is two or 1.5 times longer than its year. So there's all these things that astronomers had believed that planet formation in other systems would occur in the same way that they have here, and there's possibly a lot of planet or planetary systems they could find that confer that. But then what's happened is a lot of planetary systems are different than ours. And as I've talked about before, Jupiter was a marauding planet. It moved around the solar system and influenced the development of our solar system. In some circles, it's called the godfather of planets here on in the Milky, no, in our solar system, and it had a big effect, and it continues to have a big effect on how planets have developed in our solar system. And in particular, Mars, it could have robbed Mars of some of the material it could have accreted to become bigger, and maybe it influenced the development of Mars and whatever happened in the past and what's happening now. And so these rocky planets that they find are too close to their stars. So basically, I believe it's the M-type stars, which are called red dwarfs. 70% of the stars in the Milky Way are M-type stars, which are red dwarfs. So there was so much interesting stuff to listen to, and of course, I can say that over and over again, but it is amazing what kind of discoveries when you listen to people, they're very precise. They say, like, okay, if an alien's looking at our sun and looking at the third planet from our sun, if they can measure the atmosphere, then the conclusion can be drawn that, okay, there's oxygen in atmosphere, there's carbon, there's methane. These can't be produced by processes other than life processes. So, a lot of interesting stuff in terms of exoplanet. And I just wanted to also make another correction. I could have said the Andromeda Galaxy, I could have said it was 5 billion light years or 2 billion. I believe it's anywhere between 2.5 to 3 billion light years from our galaxy and from our Milky Way. And I believe the Triangulum Galaxy is in that same range. So whenever this is talked about, the merging of the Milky Way and Andromeda, I've never before heard if the Triangulum Galaxy will merge with the Milky Way. And the time it will merge, it will be about 4.5 billion years. But again, one thing I was reading, some of these things do change, so I could always blame that on when I make a mistake. I could say, "Oh, it's not my fault. Things are being refined, and we're always finding data that gives us a new number." So basically, if I say a wrong number, I'm gonna just make the excuse that okay, they keep updating things, so it's confused me immensely. So that's why I make my mistakes. But then again, I read something last year about when X-ray images or some kind of other image other than visible light was taken of Andromeda, it was found that Andromeda is bigger than previously thought. So if Andromeda is bigger than previously thought, it's possible the Milky Way is bigger than previously thought. So the two galaxies are closer together, so they might merge quicker than people believe. But anyway, for all this babbling, I just wanted to make an excuse for all the wrong data I've been putting into your minds. So I am very sorry about that. So another thing that I think is very interesting to cover, through my 7 years of doing this show, there's things like I've heard that if there was less carbon in our universe and more nitrogen or something like that, the speed of light would be different. Or it could work the other way. If the speed of light was different, there could be different amounts of carbon and nitrogen in our universe. And also, if the gravitational constant was a little bit weaker, there would not have been enough gravity to form stars, and we would not have existed. There would have been no stars. But if the gravitational constant or the amount of gravity in the universe was bigger, then stars would have burned out quicker because it would have been so much gravity to put the stars on a death march where they would use up their fuel much quicker. So there's all these little things that we think about, maybe we don't think about and should be thought about, because we exist because the conditions are perfect for us to exist. And it could be called the anthropic principle. It could be. I recall that name. But they were talking about some other measurements in terms of the Earth. If the Earth was a couple of percentage, a few percentage points closer to the sun, then all the water on Earth would have boiled away and there possibly would not have been any life. If the Earth was a few percentage points farther from the sun, it could have been covered in ice and life could not have formed. So there's all these things, all these millions and trillions of things, these chance things that happened, and they led to us existing, which is wonderful. So all these things that we don't think about are good things to think about. So I'm going to go for a break now, and look at this. A giant black hole keeps evading detection, and scientists can't explain it. Okay. Another one, does it snow in space? I will talk about this, maybe. I have quite a few articles here. When I come back, so I'm going to go for our break. And when I come back, I'm going to talk more astronomy. This is Marco for the first show of January 2021. So that is for January the 7th. I'll be right back in a couple minutes.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
If you or someone you know is experiencing challenges with mental health, there are lots of peer and professional resources available at UBC and in the community.
Kaleidoscope is a peer-run mental health support group on campus that meets every Monday, except statutory holidays, from 5 to 6 p.m. in Buchanan Building B, Room 307.
You can visit our website for updated meeting times and additional mental health resources at the-kaleidoscope.com.
If you live in Vancouver and need immediate help, please phone Mental Health Emergency Services at 604-874-7307 or 1-800-SUICIDE for the rest of British Columbia.
Okay, welcome back. I'm just reading more about the Planck length, and the Planck length is defined as the square root of h, which is the h bar, which is the Planck constant, times the gravitational constant, divided by c cubed. So I'm going to look at the Planck constant, and maybe that's where I got my numbers mixed up. So let's see, the Planck constant is equal to 6.6.26 times 10 to the minus 34 meters squared per kilogram per second. So what is the Planck constant in mean in simple term? The Planck constant links the amount of energy a photon carries with the frequency of its electromagnetic wave. It is named after the physicist Max Planck. SI units the Planck constant at exactly 6.6260715 times 10 to the minus 34 joule seconds. And what is the Planck constant change? Planck identified his game-changing constant in 1900, essentially putting the quanta in quantum mechanics by describing how the tiniest bits of matter release energy in discrete bundles called quanta. In other words, energy transfers occur in set amounts rather than continuous flows. Okay, so that's all about, and for the astronomer, or for the people that work in with the Planck constant, I bow to you. Okay, so one Planck length is approximately equal to 1.616255 repeater times 10 to the 35 meters. Okay, so that's how many Planck lengths are how many Planck lengths are in 1 meter. So the theoretical significance, and I'll be finished with this soon, so I'm sorry I'm boring you guys. The Planck length is a scale at which quantum gravitational effects are believed to begin to be apparent, where interactions require a working theorem of quantum gravity to be analyzed. Easy for me to say, huh? So what did that mean? Well, I'm not going to tell you guys, because I don't want to expose all these secrets. I'm just going to go on. So now, first story is, we finally know when our Milky Way galaxy will crash into the Andromeda galaxy. But again, take this with a grain of salt, because this could be changed next year, or 5 years, or 10 years from now. Our Milky Way galaxy, this is an article in space.com, dated February 8th, 2019, and the name of the article is, we will finally know when our Milky Way galaxy will crash into the Andromeda galaxy. Again, using that word crash. After the galaxies merge, basically what I've read is it's going to look like a shipwreck. Our two galaxies will look all mangled up. But it could be a slow merging. And there's a lot of space out there, so it's possible that a lot of systems won't be affected, a lot of star systems. Our Milky Way galaxy will survive in its current form a bit longer than some astronomers had thought, a new study suggests. So as I said, I read something a couple years ago that said it will not survive longer, it will be a shorter survival time, so it will crash into, not crash, they will merge quicker than thought, but now this says it will take longer to merge. The monster collision between our Milky Way and fellow spiral galaxy Andromeda will occur about 4.5 billion years from now, according to new research, which is based on observations made by the Europe's Gaia spacecraft. Some prominent previous estimates had predicted the crash would happen significantly sooner, in about 3.9 billion years. And again, what I've read and what I can recall is the two galaxies will fly past each other, and then they will turn around and then merge after that. So says Gaia project scientist Timo Prusti, and quote, this finding is crucial to our understanding of how galaxies evolve and interact, end quote. Gaia launched in December 2013 to help researchers create the best 3D map of the Milky Way ever constructed. The spacecraft has been precisely monitoring the positions and movements of huge number of stars and other cosmic objects. The mission team aims to track more than 1 billion stars by the time Gaia shuts its sharp eye for good. Most of the stars are in the Milky Way, but some are in nearby galaxies. In the new study, the researchers tracked a number of stars in our galaxy, in Andromeda, also known as M31, and in the spiral triangulum, or M33. So let's see now if it tells if these three will merge, not just two. These neighbor galaxies are within 2.5 to 3 million light years of the Milky Way and may be interacting with each other, study team member said. Lead author Roland van der Merrill of the Space Science Institute in Baltimore, and quote, "We needed to explore the galaxy's motions in 3D to uncover how they have grown and evolved and what creates and influences their features and behaviors. We were able to do this using the second package of high-quality data released by Gaia in April 2018, end quote. This work allowed the team to determine their rotation rates of both M31 and M33, something that had never been done before. So, again, when they give us these numbers, the research is so complicated. Again, I take my hats off to these galaxy-sized brains that these researchers have, because they're so clever in discovering all this stuff. Using the Gaia-derived findings and analyses of archival information, the study team mapped out how M31 and M33 have moved through space in the past and where they'll likely go over the next few billion years. Yeah, these guys will be around in a few billion years from now, won't they? The team's models gave a later-than-expected date for the Andromeda-Milky Way smash-up and also suggest it will be more of a sideswipe than a head-on collision. Because the distance between stars are so great, the odds that our own solar system will be disrupted by the merger are very low. But the crash will definitely liven up the night sky for any creatures that are around on the Earth 4.5 billion years from now. So, says Prousty again in quote, Gaia was designed primarily for mapping stars within the Milky Way, but this new study shows that the satellite is exceeding expectations and can provide unique insights into the structure and dynamics of galaxies beyond the realm of our own. The longer that Gaia watches the tiny movements of these galaxies across the sky, the more precise our measurements will become, end quote. So these mapping projects are really quite fascinating, how I'm sure Kepler and then now TESS are mapping the sky for these planets and getting information and data about all these exoplanets. And now the Gaia satellite is mapping the sky for all these galaxies. So there's so much more that is being learned and so much data coming in. And as I've previously said, for this just jogged my memory in terms of the Cassini mission in Saturn. Scientists have said we'll be looking at the data for the next 30, 40, 50 years. There's so much data coming in, so much data to be crunched. It's amazing how much knowledge we are taking in all the time. The new study was published this month in the Astrophysics Journal. Astrophysical Journal. By the way, Andromeda won't be the next galaxy our Milky Way slams into. The large magellanic cloud of Milky Way will merge about 2.5 billion years from now, a recent study suggested. So what I was thought was happening with the large magellanic cloud, where the Milky Way is already ripping stars from the large magellanic cloud and is taking in those stars as we speak. And I believe there's something called the Magellanic Stream, where the stars can be viewed moving across into the Milky Way. So we're going to slam into the Andromeda, this study said. It won't be so soon, it'll be longer, it'll take longer. And here's a nice picture of the Andromeda galaxy, also known as M31, with measurements of the motions of stars within the galaxy. Thus, this spiral galaxy is the nearest large neighbor of our Milky Way. So it's quite beautiful, of course it is. When I first saw the Andromeda, it was stunning. I was overcome almost. It was just wonderful. And as I said, I went up one time to Seymour Mountain. I took out my telescope at night trying to find Andromeda. I found it, but then all of a sudden something in the bushes was moving close to me. Closer and closer. It was dark at night, so I didn't know what it was. So my telescope and me went quickly into my car and I zoomed off. And again, I went up to what's it called, the Hoover Dam, in the North Shore. I believe it's on the way to Grouse Mountain. There's some kind of dam there. And if You guys are mad at me that I don't remember the name. I don't remember it, but I'll probably remember right after the show. The night sky is beautiful up there, and you can go see a lot of really cool things up there. So I also remember, so we look up, when I saw the Andromeda, it was right up top, right at the top of the sky. So people have asked me over time, how can you tell the difference between, you look in the sky and you say, oh, that's pretty bright. Is that a planet or a star? So the first clue that I told them was, if you look out towards Grouse Mountain or high in the sky, like right at the top of the sky, that won't be a planet, because you got to look along the ecliptic, which is the parent path of the sun, and that's where the planets are. So that's, everybody here knows that because they're clever astronomers. So I'll move on to the next. Before I say anything, that let's take a look a little bit about TESS over the course. So that's the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. Over the course of 2 years, TESS is expected to ultimately detect about 1,250 transiting exoplanets orbiting the targeted stars, an additional 13,000 transiting planets orbiting additional stars in the field that TESS observed. As of May 10, 2020, TESS has identified 1,835 candidate exoplanets, of which 46 have been confirmed so far. After the end of the primary mission around July 4, 2020, which was maybe 6 months ago, yes, exactly 6 months ago, data from the prime mission will continue to be searched for planets, while extended mission will continue to acquire additional data. The primary mission objectives for TESS is to survey the brightest stars near the Earth for transiting exoplanets over a two-year period. Some little pop-down came down. I don't know why it did. It gave me some information about TESS, or the James Webb Space Telescope. There, so I'll read that. The James Webb Space Telescope is a space telescope that is planned to succeed Hubble as NASA's flagship astrophysics mission. JWST will provide improved infrared resolution and sensitivity over Hubble and will enable a broad range of investigations. So I believe one of the things that will... I see what happens. Duh, why am I so dumb? When you hover your mouse thing, your arrow, over a highlighted thing, that's when the James Webb Space Telescope comes by. And then I hovered it over TESS, and believe it or not, wow. you guys are probably laughing at me because I didn't know that before. So I hover over something and it gives me information. Isn't that great? So I'm going to talk about the Explorers program for a second. The Explorers program is a U.S. space exploration program that provides flight opportunities for physics, geophysics, heliophysics, and astrophysics investigations from space. Launched in 1958, Explorer 1 was the first spacecraft of the United States to achieve orbit. So that's all cool stuff. So what did I learn tonight? If you hover something over a highlighted or a bolded word, it gives you a little information, nuggets of information. So everybody knew that except me. So I've been made again to look pretty stupid. So here I'm highlighting over the Kepler Space Telescope. And Kepler is a retired space telescope launched by NASA to discover Earth-sized planets orbiting other stars. Named after astronomer Johannes Kepler, the spacecraft was launched on March 7, 2009 into an Earth-trailing heliocentric orbit. Okay, so I learned something today. So let's move on to another topic. And what's another topic to study? I already looked at the Zeppelin second, so let's see what I can look at now. I'm going to go to space and physics because I didn't open enough pages. Isn't that nice? I'm going to keep you guys in suspense because I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to read next. Here you go. And here's how to watch the stunning quadrantic meteor shower tonight. and why not do this? 9 epic space discoveries you may have missed in 2020. Okay, so now I'm going to press the button on my little recorder, and I'm already 39 minutes in, so why not give your guys' ear a break? I'm going to go for a little break myself, and when we come back, we're going to talk more astronomy on AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Discorder magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
Quite exciting for me to pursue this field of astronomy even as an amateur, because for some reason, well, I can say astronomy gives me the biggest thrills of my life, because I'm an old man now. Not young anymore, so I can't do things that young people do, but astronomy is just learning about astronomy. It's like tonight, I could have come across this before, but I believe what I learned was that 77% of the stars in our galaxy are smaller than the Earth, are smaller than the Sun, and most of these stars are called red dwarfs or M-type stars. And these are stars that astronomers believe could be stars that host exoplanets that are rocky planets, that are Earth-like planets that could be in the habitable zone. So I learned that tonight, and believe it or not, I am thrilled with these things. So, 70% of the stars in the Milky Way are M-type stars. So they're red dwarf stars. And that means they could last for a long, long time. So there's some anomalies. I guess I'll call it an anomaly, because when we're comparing our solar system with other potential solar systems that have been discovered, there's planets that orbit their star every 3.5 days, or planets that orbit their stars very close in, and it challenges traditional thoughts on, for example, how could a gas giant orbit so close to its star? So the model that I heard about tonight was that it's more efficient for solar systems to make smaller planets, and also that gas giants, I believe, form much quicker than the rocky planets like our Earth. Okay, so I'm going to talk about now the largest canyon in the solar system, revealed in stunning new images. It's nearly 10 times as long as the Grand Canyon and 3 times as deep. But how did it form? Whenever we're talking about things like this, I went to the Grand Canyon for the first time about 4 or 5 years ago, and it just, your jaw drops, because you look at it and you think the hand of God reached down and carved this canyon out. There's no other way that anything, any process could have done it except God. It's so beautiful. It's so perfect. It's so, the top is just flat. It's level. And the canyon goes down, and now we found a canyon that's 10 times longer than the Grand Canyon. So I predict they probably found it on Jupiter, so we'll see. No, sorry, on Pluto. So we'll see what this says. But it is also 3 times deep. And this just, I just recall something that I heard on the show tonight was about the volcanism, how volcanism is important for life. So basically, I believe the scientist said some form of volcanism is needed to recycle the carbon. So there's a carbon cycle on our Earth, and I think it's called the carbon silicate cycle, where carbon is transferred back and forth between the ground and the atmosphere. And if some alien species is looking at our solar system and they're studying our planet from very far away, like we now study other planets, there's certain telltale signs or signatures. As I said before, there's got to be some process other than a natural process that could produce oxygen and methane. So this scientist said tonight, it's just not possible for anything other than life to produce these things. So life has to produce the oxygen and the methane and the other things. And there's also the carbon silicate cycle, or it could just be called the carbon cycle, and it could be a 12-year cycle. I'm just babbling because these are numbers I remember. Sometimes I don't write things down, so I'm left to my feeble memory. So now I'm going to look at this. Sometimes it's not so feeble, it's not bad. So the largest canyon in the solar system revealed in stunning new images. This was by Brandon Spector on livescience.com, and it's dated 11 hours ago, so that would be Monday, January 4th, because I'm speaking to you now. It's 1:30 a.m. Tuesday morning, so I am a night owl. And here we go. So largest canyon in the solar system revealed in stunning new images. So here's a close-up photo. Oh, it's Mars. Okay. A close-up photo of part of Mars' Valles Marineris, the single largest canyon in the solar system. Looks quite impressive. Is there a face there? Yeah, there's a face. Wow. Cool. There's like a face-like image carved out in this canyon. I'm sure a lot of astronomers have seen it before. So, again, this article is called Largest Canyon in the Solar System Revealed in Stunning New Images on livescience.com. About 87 million miles or 150 million kilometers above the Grand Canyon, an even larger, grander abyss cuts through the gut of the Red Planet. I thought there was also a canyon on Pluto, so that's why I said I thought that this Great Canyon might be on Pluto, but no, it's on Mars, the Red Planet. Known as Valles Marineris, this system of deep, vast canyon runs more than 2,500 miles or 4,000 kilometers along the Martian equator, spanning nearly a quarter of the planet's circumference. This gash in the bedrock of Mars is nearly 10 times as long as Earth's Grand Canyon and 3 times deeper, making it the single largest canyon in the solar system. I believe there's also a big canyon in Mexico called the Copper Canyon. So why don't I look that up? I'll say Copper Canyon, and let's see what it gives back to me. The Copper Canyon. I pressed the wrong button. So here's Wikipedia, where a lot of our information comes from. Copper Canyon, or in Spanish, Barrancas del Cobre, is a group of 6 distinct canyons in the Sierra Madre Occidental in the southwestern part of the state of Chihuahua in northwest Mexico, that is 25,000 square miles in size. The canyons were formed by 6 rivers that drain the western side of the Sierra Tarahumara, a part of the Sierra Madre Occidental. All 6 rivers merge into the Rio Fuerte and empty into the Gulf of California. The walls of the canyon are a copper green color, which is the origin of its name. So let's see about size, and what does it say about size? I just wanted to know, there's a lot of tourism going down there. I really heard it's quite, you're on the edge of your seat if you take a train ride through there, because the train apparently goes through these high tracks through the canyon, and it's not for the faint-hearted. So there's a railroad that comprises 405 miles and 86 tunnels. The total trip takes about 15 hours and passes through towns as well as the towering cliffs of the canyon. Along the railway, many Tarahumaras lay out their food, crafts, and other wares for sale. So a lot of canyons in the solar system, but this is the biggest one on Mars. And let's get back to this. Okay. using an incredibly high resolution camera called HiRISE, short for High Resolution Imaging Science Experiment, aboard the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Scientists have been taking close-up shots of the planet's strangest features since 2006, despite some truly breathtaking images of Valles Marineris, like the one below, posted to the HiRISE website on December 26, 2020. Scientists still aren't sure how the Gargantuan Canyon complex formed. So when you think right away, you think, aha, if a canyon like that formed, and we know how the Grand Canyon formed through rivers flowing through it, so there must have been flowing rivers through Mars before. So now I went to the HiRISE website. So go to this, please. It's very interesting. This story is on Live Science, and it's called Largest Canyon in the Solar System Revealed in Stunning New Images, and it's dated January the 4th. And if you go about half a page down, it says posted to the HiRISE website, and I clicked it, so now I'm on the HiRISE website. So the HiRISE website, of course, is UA, so University of Arizona, HiRISE.org. And it shows a picture Saturday, 26 December, of a beautiful chasm, I guess it's called, or chasma. And it says the obliquity of Mars, periodic bedding in Tithonium chasma. Earth seasons are caused by the tilt of our planet's rotational axis to the orbital plane, or obliquity. So now I've learned another word, obliquity. Mars's obliquity is currently about 25 degrees, which is not much different from Earth's 23 degrees. However, numerical calculations by scientists at the Paris Observatory and Massachusetts Institute of Technology suggest that this near agreement is a coincidence. So I want to... Okay. Anyway, you can go to this HiRISE website, and there's like... Anaglyphics, DTM, whatever that means. HiView, let's go to HiView. So HiView probably shows a lot of, isn't that beautiful? Look at these beautiful pictures of Mars, and they have little graphs that explain it. So astronomy is grand. Unlike Earth's Grand Canyon, Valles Marineris probably wasn't carved out by billions of years of rushing water. Oh, so that answered my question. I thought it was rushing water. The red planet is too hot and dry to have ever accommodated a river large enough to slash through the crust like that. However, the European Space Agency has said there is evidence that flowing water may have deepened some of the canyon's existing channels hundreds of millions of years ago. A majority of the canyon probably cracked open billions of years earlier when a nearby supergroup of volcanoes known as the Tharsis region was first thrusting out of the Martian soil, the ESA said. As magma bubbled up beneath these monster volcanoes, which include Olympus Mons, the largest volcano in the solar system, the planet's crust easily could have stretched, ripped, and finally collapsed into the troughs and valleys that make up Valles Marineris today, according to the European Space Agency. So I was thinking earlier also about the comment that one of the professors made about the influence that volcanism has had on certain moons and planets in the solar system. So much to study in astronomy. Efferson suggests that subsequent landslides, magma flows, and yes, even some ancient rivers probably contributed to the canyon's continued erosion over the following eons. Further analysis of high-resolution photos like these will help solve the puzzling origin story of the solar system's grandest canyon. So that was a nice article, but again, I'd say, when are we going to Mars? Elon Musk! That's the person we need to bring us to Mars, because it's going to take eons. Okay, so I'm going to just, the next few minutes, just read a couple of things. 9 epic space discoveries you may have missed in 2020. Okay, first one, radio mission. So this is on livescience.com 3 days ago, which is January the 1st. Number one is radio missions from an alien world. Planets in the solar system emit radio waves, especially Jupiter with its intense magnetic field. But no one had ever detected radio waves coming from a planet beyond the solar system until this year, when researchers picked up a signal from a gas giant in the Tau Boot system, just 51 light years away. That signal could help them learn more about the exoplanet's magnetic field, which could offer clues to what's going on in this atmosphere. Another discovery was X-ray blobs bursting from the Milky Way. Millions of years ago, an explosion in the center of the Milky Way blasted energized material above and below the galactic disk. That material is still visible, glowing in the gamma ray spectrum. In two clumps discovered in 2010, known as the Fermi bubbles. In 2020, researchers found another part of blobs in the same region, visible in the X-ray spectrum, likely related to the Fermi bubbles. These dim gargantuan features of the Milky Way tower over the 25,000 light year Fermi bubbles to a width of 45,000 light years end to end. Researchers named them the E. Rosita bubbles. Okay, so before I go on to the third discovery, I was going to earlier talk about fast radio bursts and I forgot all about it, so I'll do that next show. But basically, these fast radio bursts are in the news now, so I'll talk about it later. A long lost rocket booster. Story number three. Earth acquired a new mini moon in 2020, one of several objects that the planet encounters from space from time to time that end up in orbit around their planet. But closer examination by amateur and professional space watchers revealed this mini moon wasn't a natural object at all, but rather a rocket booster NASA launched in 1960. Okay, I'll go quickly. Next one is a million new galaxies. A radio telescope in the Australian outback named 83% or mapped 83% of the observable universe over the course of 300 hours of observations and revealed a big haul of data, 3 million galaxies, a full million of which had never been seen before. The Australian Square Kilometer Array Pathfinder, or ASKAP, ASCAP, relies on 36 antennas to record the sky, but that was the first time all 36 has been used at once for a single project. A newborn magnetar. On November 12th, researchers detected a bright kilonova, a light show from the aftermath of two neutron stars merging together. Kilonovas are rare in space, but researchers have seen them before. This one was special, though. Weird signals in that kilonova light indicated the presence of something new. Researchers studying the event offered a few possibilities, but said the most likely is a newborn magnetar, a huge super magnetic neutron star that formed during the collision. And what's going to take us out, of course, the sort of fast radio burst. So the last story, I haven't read them all, but this is the last one I will read, the source of a fast radio burst. There's a diagram here and it says a magnetar is a super dense neutron star with an extremely strong magnetic field. In this illustration, the magnetar is emitting a burst of radiation, and that's probably what a fast radio burst is. So I'll read the little clip under this. Magnetars may also be responsible for the brightest flashes of light in space. These fast radio bursts have mystified astronomers for years, packing the energy the sun emits in days into just milliseconds. Most seem to come from far beyond the Milky Way, but in 2020, researchers reported a fast radio burst originating in our home galaxy just 30,000 light years from Earth. And this one had a known point of origin, a magnetar. Does that mean that all such bursts come from magnetars? No one is sure. So, thank you for listening. Next time, I promise I'm going to look into fast radio bursts because astronomers seem to be talking a lot about fast radio bursts these days. So I hope everybody has a good year. This is Marco. You have been listening to AstroTalk for the first show of the year, January 7th, on CITR 101.9.